Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sennett, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, I have to say, on my 2020 bingo card for this podcast, I did not predict us talking about Mike Bloomberg and farming, but this is the world we live in. So in the last few days, this clip of Bloomberg, which is from an event in 2016 in Oxford, has been making the rounds online. And here is what he said. This is as it was reported in the New York Post. I'll read you the quote. This is Bloomberg speaking. I could teach anybody, even people in this room, no offense intended, to be a farmer. Bloomberg told the audience, the Distinguished Speaker Series at the University of Oxford Said Business School. It's a process. You dig a hole, you put a seed in, you put dirt on top, add water, up comes the corn. The former three-term New York City mayor also addressed worker skills during the Industrial Revolution. It's again quoting Bloomberg. You put the piece of metal on the lathe, you turn the crank in the direction of the arrow, and you can have a job. And we created a lot of jobs. At one point, 98% of the world worked in agriculture. Today, it's 2% in the United States, Bloomberg said. He then pointed out the difference between the economy then and today's information economy. Quote, it's built around replacing people with technology, and the skill sets that you have to learn are how to think and analyze. And that is a whole degree level different. You have to have a different skill set. You have to have a lot more gray matter, close quote. Okay, Victor, so you're a farmer with a PhD from Stanford, so you are better positioned than almost anyone I can imagine to parry with this argument. By Bloomberg's definition, farming is a sufficiently basic skill set that pretty much anyone can do it, not terribly cognitively demanding. You've been at this for decades. Compare that statement with the reality that you've experienced and that you've seen other farmers experience.
Yeah, I mean, if he was right, we would never have the word famine in our vocabulary, would we? And we wouldn't have had, you know, even Stalin couldn't kill 20 million people by starving them to death. So it's hard to know what he meant in the sense that he's now claiming he was giving a riff on the history of labor and agriculture and industry, and he meant ancient farmers. But if he meant ancient farmers, they just dug a hole and threw a seed and bam, up came corn. I guess he's talking about the New World because they didn't have corn in the Old World until 16th century. But my point is that it wasn't true in the ancient world. It was very, very hard. And we know that because Herodotus, Thucydides, Tacitus, Livy's, they're full of stories of mass famine. And we have very sophisticated agricultural treatises, Columella, Varro, the elder Cato, Theophrastus, that go into great depth about plant science. My point is that when you plant something or you're farming, say, from the blossom on a fruit tree to the plum or the peach or the nectarine or the almond, you have to deal with the weather. You have to deal with a long-range climate. You have to deal with insects. You have to deal with fungi, with mold. You have to deal with frost. And you have to deal with insects, worms, you know, mites. You have to deal with human predators, people who, you know, come in and try to take your place, or they want to steal your crop, or the government wants to, you know, put you out of business, or you're going to have to follow the market. Some of the best crops I ever produced, big, beautiful red nectarines, the price fell on that commodity because it was a particular time of the year when people didn't eat nectarines. And every year they weren't worth the cost of harvesting them. So you're dealing with so many variables. And that's in the ancient and modern world. And he seems to be completely oblivious to that. It's almost like saying you just flip on the switch and the lights go on. Well, in some sense they do, but that's a whole chain of people that are involved from the generators to the transmission lines. And these are pretty tough customers that go out at 2 in the morning and make sure that power line's not down. And that technology hasn't really changed much in the last 100 years. So I guess what I'm saying is that whether he was talking about the ancient or the modern world, farming is always an art, and the people who do it are very good at what they do, and we know that because 2%, about 3.5 million Americans, produce food for 330 million people. And they're very sophisticated people. They use GPS, they use computers, they use complex machinery, they're mathematicians, they follow markets, they know about interest and dividends and investments. But in addition to that, i.e., that is, they know the world of Michael Bloomberg, he doesn't know their world. He doesn't get up and have some employee says, I think I'm going to take you out today. Or he doesn't have some packer who says to him, I'm not going to pay you, not today, not tomorrow. He may have that in the business world, but not the physical business world, where somebody gets in Mike Bloomberg's face and, or, you know, a cow kicks him in the head or something. So it's a physical, muscular world in addition to a mental world. And the second thing is he went beyond that and kind of gave away the game when he said, well, I was just talking about the history, when he said, you know, when we're in the informational age, we need people with more gray matter. And it was gray matter meaning you have to be, I guess, genetically smarter to code or to work on the internet than you would be today to grow food. I'm not sure that's true. In fact, I know it's not true. I had a unique perspective because for 30 years, I would get up in the morning and farm for 4 hours and then drive 30 miles to a California State University campus and teach classics and then drive back and get on a tractor. And I can tell you the people that I met farming were far more versatile and they were far more engaged in the real natural world than the people in academia. I mean, I would be at a faculty meeting and somebody would drop coffee on somebody's shoe and he would almost cry, and you'd go home and the guy would lose his finger on a grinder and wouldn't even whimper. That's a true story. And so I guess what I'm saying is that he's such a sheltered person for being a self-acknowledged multi-billionaire man of the world, Renaissance figure. He's been all over the world and yet he's been nowhere.
So let me ask you about precisely that point, because you have written in the past about the urban-rural divide in this country. And someone like Mike Bloomberg is an extreme example of this, because this is a man who's so cosmopolitan that after being mayor of New York City, he reportedly flirted the idea with becoming the mayor of London. But an interesting data point that I think about sometimes, the five biggest metropolitan areas in the U.S., that's New York, L.A., Chicago, Dallas-Fort Worth, and Houston, they are all represented in the most recent presidencies, five of the last six, if you think about it. Trump from New York, Reagan from L.A., Obama from Chicago, George W. Bush from Dallas, and his father from Houston. Bill Clinton coming out of Arkansas is the one exception. And without reading too much symbolic value into that, it does sort of feel like our national politics are becoming at least proportionately more urban. And so I wonder if you've sensed that in the decades that you've been at this. Is urban America more out of touch with rural America than it used to be?
Oh, yeah, it is. And it's not just because of technology. You think technology would have made them more symbiotic, connected them, but I think it's globalization. I think the East Coast is a window on Europe, and the West Coast is a window on China, India, Japan, and Korea. And that universities, law firms, Hollywood, Wall Street, all of Silicon Valley, where the real great money is insurance, finance, high tech, tends to govern and adjudicate trade to Asia and to Europe. And the people in the middle, we can't press it too far, but they are stereotypically still the people with muscles. They farm, they log, they mine, they build things. And somehow these people on the coast felt that these people, you know, these are the people we call, you know, deplorables, or we call Mike Bloomberg, he says, you know, they don't have gray matter. Joe Biden said they were the dregs, usually in connection with a Trump supporter, but they don't have a lot of respect for them. They're the clingers that Obama talked about. And yet, in their own daily lives, they tend to be highly dependent upon them. You and I can't get by for 2 days without food. We can get by for a year without Bloomberg News. And that's true of a lot of stuff. When I was farming, if I didn't have insurance, I could make it for a month. But if I couldn't eat, or didn't have fuel, I couldn't survive 2 days. And yet, the irony is that these people, the farming class, have been so successful that they put themselves out of mind, out of sight, by guaranteeing cheap, safe, clean, nutritious food. And they're sort of like the power that we all just expect to go on when we flip a switch. And so people like Bloomberg need to just take a deep breath and, you know, ask where his food is. But more importantly, it fits a narrative with him. You know, there's a sense now with this candidate that if he wants to be mayor for three terms, he can change the rules. If he wants to get in the debate stage, and there's Democratic rules about how you raise money and how much, he can change the rules. When he wants to make these statements about minority youth or about redlining or whatever the particular topic is, he sounds Olympian, and he's Zeus pontificating. And I don't quite understand why he's in the race, because he's antithetical to all the professions, what the Democrats have professed. They were against toxic masculinity, white male, billionaires, et cetera, et cetera. And then to save them, they brought this guy in that is the antithesis, as I said, of everything that they've said for the last 9 months. So I've been bewildered by him in general, and then the people in the Democratic Party who seem to welcome him in particular.
You know, it occurs to me that when we're talking about cultural divides in American life, that one of the big ones right up there with urban-rural, and I think we've talked about it on the show before, is the military-civilian divide. And this question makes me wonder, Victor, how much do those overlap? I mean, the South, for instance, is famously overrepresented in the military.
You know, that's interesting. I once wrote a book, Carnage and Culture, and I had a chapter on the Tet Offensive. So I spent a lot of time looking at casualty rates in Vietnam. And I had been brought up on the campus where I was told that minority youth inordinately died given their proportions in the general population. And then when you look at the data from Gulf War I and Gulf War II in Afghanistan, it's pretty clear that that's not the case. The people who are dying inordinately are usually white people, and they now make about 70%. They usually die at about 82 or 83% in recent wars, in Vietnam even higher. But it's not just white people. It's white people from south of the Mason-Dixon line and more in between the two coasts. And so those are the, you know, the deplorables are dying in wars that, and that was the argument Trump made, you're dying in endless wars that were thought up or dreamed up by people on the coast. That was a simplification, kind of a demagogic thing to say, but there was a lot of truth to it. And so these people, I think what Bloomberg doesn't get quite is it's the children of people who work with their hands in manufacturing that he made fun of, the lathe operator or the farmer, that they always tend to pay the price for globalization or for an optional war overseas, and then we're supposed to be impressed by his money. And nobody really is. It's shocking how angry that statement got, because for the fact that he offended 2% of the population, it was just everybody sort of got angry about it, because they felt it wasn't just about farmers, it was about people in between the coast and that use their hands and make things. And here this guy just walks in and writes off this half of the country. And when you synthesize that with his remarks about, you know, minority youth are putting them up against a wall, or what he said about women, or he said something about black maid, all of that stuff together, you're wondering, what advantages does he really bring to the table against Trump? He was supposed to be a moderate that would appeal to suburban professional women, or a big city mayor that knew how to deal with minorities, or he was a moderate that might win over old blue dog Democrats. And these are precisely the constituencies that he's not going to appeal at all to.
So let's end with the politics around this, not specific to the Bloomberg remarks, but the bigger policy environment, because these days, farmers aren't really talked about as often as a political bloc as they used to be. You've heard it a little more, though, the last few years, just because trade has been so front and center. And what's interesting here is everyone claims that they're protecting the farmers. So President Trump claims that he's buttressing them. And then you've got on the other side the more dedicated free traders who are saying, no, you're costing them money and you're just subsidizing them on the back end. The open markets that we want are really what's best for them. So how does this play with the actual farmers that you're interacting with, Victor? What's their diagnosis of what's going on the trade front?
Well, you know, if I look at the data, and I did, that the Wall Street Journal pointed out not too long ago that 83% of people who self-identified as farmers in a recent poll, I think there were 1,500 respondents, said they supported or had a high an approval rating of Trump. They were for Trump. So when Bloomberg said, well, we're going to win the farmers, the Democrats are going to win over the farmers because they're angry, they're not. Their idea was that for years the EU with subsidized fruit, dried fruits, or subsidized dairy products, or subsidized, you know, wheat, or Japan with barriers against California rice or California beef, they feel it was asymmetrical. It still is. And that this was the first guy that came along and was willing to say the T word, tariff, and they're willing to take short-term gain, short-term pain for what they consider will be long-term gain, and that is they'll have a more equitable playing field. A couple of other peripheral issues is that, remember, in this so-called trade war, the Chinese, for reciprocal tariffs, targeted Electoral College important states, so soybeans, wheat, corn, foodstuffs for animals in places like Iowa, Illinois, Ohio, Pennsylvania, southern, you know, Michigan. And they didn't really do it on almonds. To take one example, California's big export crop, because they knew California's Electoral College was irrelevant. It was always going to be a blue state. So they're very, and they understood that even though the farmers were only 1 to 2%, 3.5 million, let's say, that because of the Electoral College in those states that are key, that are the really the only ones in play under the current calculus, that they make up about 30% in some of them, or at least their families do, and their extended families. So they're a little bit more important than just their numbers in the population because of the way the Electoral College works and the way that China tries to manipulate it on this particular issue. But I think most of the data thinks that Trump was one of the few people who was really going to do something rather than just, you know, put on a caterpillar hat and a flannel shirt and get the bale of hay backdrop and then have a photo op.
All right. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com. He's also on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.